Welcome to Perfect Dismay with Mariah and Kay. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kay.
And this week, we are covering Unsolved.
All right, so before we get into it, I did want to update you. So anybody that was around for the first episode and at the end heard me say I've never heard of Jonestown, I actually have. I just didn't know the name. I was listening to a podcast, Mystery History. And they covered the Jonestown Massacre. And then, of course, it's where the drink the Kool-Aid comes from, which mm-hmm. I absolutely knew, but I had no idea what it was called. So I listened to their podcast on it, and then I went, man, everybody thinks I'm really stupid right now. So I wanted to update you. I know what you're talking about.
Even Steven asked, he was like, I don't know much about cults, but I know about Jonestown. How does she not know about it?
Yeah, I didn't know like specific details or anything, but I have educated myself a little bit, and I'm going to be actually looking up the video of the news helicopter flyover. Mm. And I might listen to his last speech, but I'm not sure if I want to go that far.
Mm. It's pretty crazy.
At the beginning when they were talking about it, I was like, man, this is a cult I could join.
Yeah.
Just like you were saying last week. But yeah, update. I know what you're talking about.
All right. That's good. I'm not disappointed in our friendship now. So
we can continue the podcast.
We can. Okay. So this week I am actually covering a really heavy story. So I'm going to go first because Kayla's is not as sad as mine, although hers is still sad. So this week, I am covering the unsolved murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German. These murders are also known as the Delphi murders or Murder on the High Bridge. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard of the Delphi murders, but I don't know anything about it.
All right. So Delphi, Indiana was your typical small town with a population of just over 3,800 according to the 2010 census. The town was quiet and tight-knit with only one main street. In 2017, the sheriff described the town by saying, quote, it's just your typical small-town USA, everybody knows everybody, end quote. So this sounds a lot like my hometown, so I can relate to the one main street. And are you from a small town, Kayla? I know you're from, what, Tennessee?
Mm-hmm. I'm from a smaller town. We didn't have just, like, one street, though. Where are you from?
Buffalo, Missouri, and our population is only, like, 3,200.
Okay, yeah, you're from a really small town. Like, I grew up in Chattanooga. It's not really that small.
Oh, that's big, right?
It's like a small city. Okay, I grew up in, like, past the suburbs of Chattanooga. If anybody knows where Harrison Bay State Park is, that's where I grew up, so.
Oh, okay. I knew it was Tennessee, I just couldn't remember if it was small town, city, or what. However, the feelings of safety and familiarity were ripped from the town when the bodies of 13-year-old Abigail and 14-year-old Liberty were discovered on February 14th, 2017.
They're so young.
So young. But the two girls, who went by the nicknames Abby and Libby, were described as having vastly different personalities but inseparable. Both attended Delphi Community Middle School and were active on the sports team by playing softball and volleyball. The girls were also members of the school's band and played the saxophone, which when I first heard that, I was definitely like, huh, nerds. And then I remembered what happened, and I was like, oh, man.
They're so nice, though. Like, they're active in so many things. They're just so wholesome.
Yeah, they're so cute.
Yeah.
Abby was described as having an especially close relationship with her mother, Anna, and supposedly wanted to pursue a career in forensic science.
Ooh, hey.
Yeah.
We could have been friends.
Yeah, definitely. Libby was a gifted athlete and was living with her grandparents at the time. They described their granddaughter as wise beyond her years and that she wanted to be an FBI agent.
Again, someone I can relate to.
Right? I would have been friends with them. In an interview with ABC News, Libby's grandmother Becky said, quote, Libby already had her career path pretty much laid out. She wanted to work with the FBI, she wanted to solve crimes, and she wanted to help people, end quote.
That's really, I don't know if that's ironic, but that's just so weird that that's what she wanted to do with her life, and then she ended up getting murdered.
Well, just listen to what this bad bitch does before she gets murdered, because she's a bad bitch. But they're just like, you know, young true crime fans. And I was a true crime fan when I was 13, 14. So I totally would have been friends with these girls. They're just so sweet, sweet babies.
Absolutely. When I was 13 or 14, I'm pretty sure I was dead set on joining the FBI. Like, I wanted to be a criminal profiler. That was me.
Me too. I wanted to be an FBI agent, and then I learned about the culture, and I went, never mind.
Yeah, right? These girls were us.
Yeah, literally.
Except we made it past 14.
Oh my god, Kayla. That's really
sad. Sorry. Let me just toss us into a deep, dark pit for a second.
So on Monday, February 13th, the school was closed due to a holiday, so on Sunday, the girls had a sleepover at Libby's house. Libby's older sister, Kelsey, had joined them, and they stayed up late into the night watching movies and painting. So cute. That's what I did when I was young. The next day, the girls decided they want to go hiking at the Monon High Bridge Trail, which is part of the Delphi Historic Trail System. On February 13th, around 1:30 p.m., a family member dropped the girls off at the trailhead where they began their hike. So I'd read some articles stating that Libby's father had dropped them off, and then another one said Kelsey, Libby's older sister, but she lived with her grandparents, so I just went with the family member as a safe bet.
Yeah.
So Libby's father was the one who was going to pick up the girls at 3 p.m. at a designated spot. But when the girls did not arrive, he assumed they'd lost track of time and began calling Libby. After a couple of phone calls, he began to walk the paths, thinking that they just lost track of time. And this whole time he's calling Libby, and no one is answering her phone. After about 45 minutes, he calls Libby's grandmother and Abby's family, and they begin an informal search party. At 5:30 p.m., the families contacted the local police, and an official search party is started. And by 6 p.m., hundreds of volunteers had joined the search. So this is, like, a small town.
Yeah, so how long between, like, the time that the dad got there to pick them up and, like, the official search was started?
So he got there at 3 and began to walk around, and at 5:30 is when they called the police and the official search party was started. And by 6, so just 30 minutes from them calling the police, hundreds of volunteers had came out from this town to search for the girls.
Good on this town.
Yeah, right? It's just your, like, everybody looks out for everybody, we're all friends kind of town. Unfortunately, no evidence was found, and at midnight, the police were forced to make the decision to end the search and resume in the morning.
How, like, how sad is that? Can you imagine being part of the search party? You've been searching for, like, what, 6 hours? And then you have to make the call to stop searching.
Imagine being the mom. I'd be like, fuck no, get back in those woods.
That's just crazy. Because, I mean, I would go hike on a trail like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we hike out here all the time. It could happen to anyone.
It's so relatable. Yeah.
So the next morning, the searches resumed. But this time, it included the FBI, dogs, drones, and even divers who were searching the local creeks for the girls.
Nice.
Kelsey, who again is Libby's sister, had stated in an interview with Kendall Ray that she had, quote, packed a bag of granola bars and a blanket, hoping that the girls would need them. They would be so happy to have a granola bar after being outside all night, end quote. So her sister is just, like, looking out for him, you know?
Yeah, she's trying everything in her power to, like, protect them as much as she can.
Yeah. And you don't assume, like, you wouldn't automatically assume the worst. You would just think, okay, they got lost. We're going to find them. Mm-hmm. We're just going to bring them home.
What year was this again?
2017.
Okay. Oh, that's not that long ago.
Not at all. Sadly, the girls' bodies were found in the woods less than a mile from where they were dropped off. Details surrounding their deaths have never been released, nor have the police ever said that they've gathered DNA evidence. So we have no idea how they died. We have no idea if DNA was collected, but we know that they died.
How do you spend 6 hours searching? I'm not, like, trying to question the cops or anything, but how do you spend 6 hours searching the area and they're found less than a mile from where they were dropped off? So I'm assuming drop-off point and pickup point are different?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Okay, so why wouldn't that be like, hey, they obviously didn't make it to the drop or the pickup point, so why wouldn't we go back from the drop-off point and just try to recreate their steps? Isn't 2017, guys, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. And I didn't write this down, but some of the articles said that they were found on private property, so maybe that hindered the search somehow. But The person who owned the property was ruled out, so he's not
Yeah.
Not bad.
Caveat for anyone who's listening, and on the first episode we also did this, we're gonna put our citations for the articles that we use in the description, so just like click on the little dots, and just if you want to look at anything that we've looked at,
yeah,
our articles will be in there for you and linked.
Yes. So we do know from Libby's Snapchat that the girls made it to the bridge, because at around 2:03 Libby had posted a Snapchat of Abby crossing the bridge. So we know that they made it, but Libby's phone also held a lot more information about the suspect. So now, moving on to this bad bitch, Libby.
Real quick, for all you people who get mad about girls who want to continuously take photos and like put it on Instagram or Snapchat, this is how we document what happens in case we die, okay?
Exactly. So 9 days after Libby and Abby's bodies were recovered, the FBI and the investigators held a press conference where they released a short clip of who the police believe is the murderer walking towards the girls from Libby's phone. So this bitch Libby, who again wanted to be an FBI agent, realized they were in danger, sensed the bad voodoo from this man, and began to record him.
Oh my god, baller.
Like, at 14 years old.
She would have made it, too. If she had lived through that, she would have been the most badass FBI agent ever.
Oh, yeah. And so then she stuffed it into her pocket and kept recording, which is how they have audio of this guy's voice. So it's a short video of him walking up.
She's so smart.
I actually have the clip, and I want you to watch it.
Okay. So it's on a loop. Okay, I don't know what he's saying. He's just walking with his hands in his pockets and his head is down, like, what? You're on a hiking trail, bud.
I'd read, because they're on the bridge in this video, and I'd read that they're, like, the spacing between the planks in the bridge were kind of uneven and large, so he would have been walking to watch where he was stepping, is something that I'd read. But he's saying in this audio clip, it's not when he's walking up. The audio clip is at a separate time, but he's saying, guys down the hill.
Guys down the hill?
Like, guys, dot, 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 down the hill, directing the girls to move down the hill.
That's weird.
Yeah. And so originally, down the hill was the only part that was released in 2017. And then in April of 2019, the investigators released the updated sketch, which you saw in that clip, and the word guys.
All right, let me just watch it one more time. I feel like that sketch doesn't really do it justice, though. Like, the sketch kind of makes him look almost wimpier than he looks in the video.
So are you looking at the first sketch or the second sketch?
Just the one from that video. Are there two in there?
So there's one of his sketch right next to the actual suspect. And then below that, there should be one that looks less realistic, honestly.
Oh. Okay, so the one at the bottom is the first sketch.
No, the one at the bottom is the 2019 sketch. So the one at the bottom is the most updated sketch.
Okay, dude, now I'm calling this. Somebody in the FBI or the cops, somebody in one of these government agencies knows who this guy is, and their updated sketch is to help him get away with it.
Isn't that a horrible sketch?
Yes. No, like, the one at the bottom, the newest sketch I would have thought was the first, like, really quickly drawn out sketch so that they can get it out to people, because that doesn't even, I mean, yeah, it looks like him, but it doesn't capture him like the next one does, which apparently is the first sketch. Look at the level of detail.
The first sketch is really detailed, and we'll get into this, but it looks exactly like one of the suspects.
The first sketch?
Yeah, the first sketch does.
Ugh, conspiracies, guys. Oh my god.
But the second sketch really does look like, I mean, I hate to say it, but it looks like a high school student drew it or something.
It does. And, okay, their chins aren't even really the same between the sketches.
Yeah, it's completely different people.
So someone is like, oh yeah, we're just going to elongate this chin so that the real killer can get away. I'm calling it. There's a conspiracy here.
Goes all the way to the top. So from what little we have of the recording, we know that the man likely threatened the girls to walk down the hill, possibly with a gun, where he then murdered them. The police have stated they have additional recordings and videos from Libby's phone. However, they're not going to release any additional information in case an arrest is made and a trial is held.
Well, it sounds to me like they are hindering their own investigation, really.
Yeah, like, why wouldn't you release more of just his voice at minimum? Because the guys down the hill isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why they wouldn't release a lot of the stuff that they have, but it's 2021. What have we been doing with this case? The fact that you won't tell anyone how they died. They were found a mile from where the drop-off was. So, okay, so either he backtracked, right? How far away is this bridge from the drop-off point?
Oh, it's not very far. I don't have the exact measurement, but not far.
So it's probably within, like, the first mile or so, mm-hmm. then. Or a couple of miles. I'm just spitballing. But, okay, so which means they died soon after they were dropped off.
Yeah.
Which was what time?
Well, so they were dropped off at 1:30. And at 2:03, Libby had posted that photo to her Snapchat. So they were there. They were at the bridge, and they were alive for 30 minutes after being dropped off, roughly.
That's so soon. That doesn't ring like a crime of opportunity there, though.
Yeah. And like you said, it's almost like they're hindering their own investigation. Like, at least tell us the time of when these videos were taken. Because you can get all of that from a recording on a phone.
Yeah, especially in 2017.
Yeah. And the FBI is assisting you. Okay, I know their digital forensic group is very good at what they do.
Yeah, I'm just something's not right. It's fishy.
Yeah, it's very fishy. So during that 2019 conference, the police also updated their description of the suspect, which you saw way worse than the first one. Looks like a high schooler drew it, whatever. They believe the killer is between the ages of 18 to 40 years old and looks younger than he actually is. They estimate his weight to be between 160 to 200 pounds. Sergeant Kim Riley of the state police, who has served as a spokesperson for this specific investigation, said, quote, "We have a strong suspicion that the person is either from the area, has visited there before, or has worked and lived in the area for a number of years," end quote.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think this doesn't scream crime of opportunity to me, especially if you're found, like, yes, I understand that the woods are a more secluded place, but killers typically kill where they feel comfortable. And if you're just off of a trail, you're not going to murder someone unless you're in a complete frenzy. You're not going to murder someone because what if someone walks around the corner and sees you murdering these two girls? This is definitely someone who's comfortable in this environment and in this area.
Yeah.
So during this same conference, the police force also requested the public's help to identify the driver of a vehicle that was parked near the Monon Bridge on the day Abby and Libby went missing. During this conference, the police explained the vehicle was parked at the old CPS building of Delphi between noon and 5 p.m. No details to include the make, model, color, or license plate of this vehicle have been released. So they're just like, hey guys, this car was here. Does anyone know who it belongs to?
They say what kind of car? Like sedan, van?
No. Nothing. They don't even get that. They just said a car was parked here.
It's a little sus.
Yeah, it's... Come on, guys. Like, help us out a little bit here. Give us something.
Yeah. I mean, like, I can kind of see some of this stuff if it was way back, but 2017?
To this day, there have been zero major leads as to who the man in the video is. However, we have had some persons of interest. And the first person is named Daniel Nations. So,
I've heard that name before.
Go back into our chat and look at Daniel's photo.
Oh, God.
Compared to the first sketch.
Oh, let me... What? Oh. Okay, the chin is definitely... It looks the same.
And the nose! I was like, dude, it's this motherfucker.
So his nose in the actual photo looks a little bit skinnier than the one that they put, but I mean...
It's close!
This?
If I was a person in the public, I would be like, yeah, that bro right there.
You know what's really shady about this guy? The fact that, like, he's got these tiny little bang curls.
That's what you notice?
Yeah, it's gross. Okay, so this... photo that's taken, is that an actual mugshot or is it just...
Yeah.
Oh, so he's had some run-ins.
Quite a few.
Hmm.
So Daniel is a registered sex offender from Indiana and had been previously arrested for domestic battery and drug possession.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he was in Delphi around the time of the murders and has a known violent background.
What kind of car does he drive? I'm just saying, it fits the description.
Yeah, if it's a car, it fits. So how the police were tipped off to him was he was arrested in 2017 in Woodland Park, Colorado, where he was threatening strangers with a hatchet on the Monument Trail.
That's excessive.
Yeah, by the way, this trail is 20 minutes from our apartment.
Oh good. Yeah. Oh, good. So you guys are going to go out there, huh?
And see where he was threatening people. So he was driving with expired Indiana tags, where the police then found that he had an outstanding warrant for his arrest. He was arrested in Colorado, and the officers from Indiana came all the way out here to speak with him. His wife, Caitlin, did an interview with the Denver Post, and when asked if she thought her husband could kill the girls, she stated, quote, "I don't know, but he really scares the heck out of me," end quote.
So he actually, this wasn't in the past, like he got arrested in Colorado, and it was like around the time they were investigating the girls' murders?
Yeah, so he was arrested in Colorado in September, and the girls were killed in February.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and so he was driving with expired tags, and when the police ran his record, they saw that he had an outstanding warrant for his arrest. Not related to the murders, just a different warrant. So they took him in, and they called Indiana, and they said, "Hey, guys, his vehicle's registered in this area. You have an unsolved murder case. Come out here and interview this guy."
That is police communication at its finest. Thank you, yeah. Colorado.
Which is what it should always be like, but, yeah. You know.
So, and then his sex offender charge, he was charged, right?
He was charged, yeah.
Well, I mean, like, how old were the girls?
I don't have any information on that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Because you can say sex offender, and it doesn't necessarily mean that he targets children, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it could have been, like, relation with the 16, 17-year-old, which is still fucked up, but
yeah.
Not 13.
Or maybe he beat his wife or something, I don't know, which is still fucked up.
It's all fucked up. However, in February of 2018, so a year after the murder, the authorities stated that Daniel was no longer considered an active person of interest in the Delphi murder case. No information as to why he's not the active suspect.
Do they give you that information, though?
I feel like they should rule him out. How did y'all rule him out? Because in the public's opinion...
I would like to know, definitely.
Yeah, in my opinion, that motherfucker looks a lot like that first sketch. And his background is scary as fuck.
It looks pretty similar. So definitely person of interest. I could 100% agree with that. But then, I don't know, I'd have to see the rest of it. Because he could just look super similar to the sketch at the same time. And we could just be condemning this not-so-innocent guy. Because, you know, he is a sex offender, so.
Yeah. Yeah, this motherfucker ain't innocent. But... Mm-mm. He might be innocent of murder, so.
Yeah.
Next suspect is named Thomas Bruce. Thomas was brought to the police's attention because he wore a similar hat to the man in the original sketch.
Well, that hat's not very, like, that hat's not stylish. I don't know why he would wear that.
Also, apparently he's of the same height and weight of the suspect. But, connection to you, just like I have with Daniel, Bruce was a pastor in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh my God.
However, he fatally shot a woman and sexually assaulted two other victims in St. Louis.
What? When was this?
How is he the person of interest, first of all?
Did that happen before the murders or after? Because I was in St. Louis during that time, if it's after.
Yeah, I have no idea. This is just a tiny little blurb that I see about this Thomas Bruce guy. It's very tiny. And now he's in prison, awaiting for being served, potentially the death penalty.
Thomas Bruce.
You're going to Google it?
I'm going to look him up. I want to know when that happened because, oh my God. Because I moved to St. Louis in 2017.
Let's look it up.
Oh my gosh. St. Louis is dangerous.
He was charged November 26, 2018.
That's the day before my birthday.
Ugh.
Ugh.
However, the police have only named him a potential suspect and no official links have been released to the public. So, like, how's he a potential suspect?
How far away is Delphi from St. Louis?
Just Indiana, so it should be like 8 hours.
Oh, yeah. So how did the St. Louis pastor become a suspect then?
Yeah, I haven't seen any link. No official links have been released to the public. They just named him as a suspect.
That is so weird. What, they just went down like the National Sex Offender Registry and they're like, yeah, this guy is pretty sus.
Maybe he was in Delphi around the time of the murder. Maybe that's how they linked it. But they, again, haven't released anything to the public saying, hey, this is how he's linked to the murders.
Oh my. I'm like, by the end of this case, I'm not even going to be sad. I'm going to be fuming because of the lack of knowledge. Like, FOIA requests, guys.
Exactly. So the last person of interest is a man named Paul Etter. An anonymous tip was given to investigators, and he was immediately named a person of interest on July 23rd, 2019. Interestingly enough, on June 22nd, 2019, Paul was accused and wanted for the abduction and assault of a young woman. 5 days after the police announced that Paul was a suspect, he was caught in a 5-hour standoff with the police and died by suicide. So, like, what the fuck?
I completely understand giving anonymous tips, but at the same time, it makes me, like, take a step back and go, okay, well, you want to remain anonymous, but why?
Yeah, so I think anonymous tips are good. This dude is obviously a bad man, since he was wanted for abducting and assaulting a young woman. But then, when the police go to take him into custody, he immediately starts shooting at them, gets in a standoff, and then kills himself before they could get him. Like, okay, bro. What else were you doing?
Yeah, there's no telling. Like, he could have just done that just because of the abduction or the... Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't necessarily mean that he had anything to do with the Delphi murders, but... No. He's not a good guy.
None of these motherfuckers, yeah.
But when you get into a situation like that, though... why would you choose suicide instead of murder by cop? Or suicide by cop, sorry.
Well, I don't know any of that, but I just don't... I think that abduction and assault, you're not going to get as serious of a charge in comparison to murder. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure why his thought, if it was just abduction and assault, which is still horrible, it's not going to be comparable to a murder charge.
How old was this girl that he supposedly abducted?
I don't know. It just says young woman.
Well, I mean, that could be another thing. Because if he goes... Oh, okay. Because if he goes to jail or prison for abducting an underage kid, they're not going to be very nice to him. Like, it's probably a death sentence already, so...
Prison justice will get you.
Maybe that's what he was thinking. I don't know why we're trying to get into his head. Obviously, he wasn't thinking correctly if he's abducting people and then starts a shootout and a standoff with the cops. So, you're not winning that.
You're fucked up. So, despite having over 48,000 tips come in over the past 4 years, no one has been arrested for the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German. Police are still on the hunt for the suspect, and I would urge everyone to look at the suspect's video and listen to these audio clips. Again, you can remain anonymous, even if you just have a small inkling of, I think I may know this person. This person has gone through Delphi, Indiana. Just send in your tip. You should at least give the girls the justice of at least looking at these photos. That's the minimum that you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. We won't judge you for saying anonymous like I just did a minute ago.
So if anyone has any additional information, you can make a 100% anonymous tip at the Delphi Homicide Tip Line at 844-459-5786. Tips can also be made at the Central Indiana Crime Stoppers Line at 317-262-8477. And that is the case of the unsolved murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German.
I want to investigate this on my own. I want to know, how they were murdered. And honestly, they might not be releasing it because it might just be extremely brutal.
So they've released more brutal murder, or not more, but they've released brutal murders before. Like, we know how BTK killed an 11-year-old girl. And I think that releasing how someone was murdered is not always good, but it can reveal a lot about the killer. It reveals a lot about, were they a frenzy killer? Was it just one gunshot to the head to get it over quickly? And, you know, the DNA evidence is so big. Do you guys have any DNA evidence found at the scene that links you to the suspect.
Yeah. I know that the...
Yeah, this case is just frustrating, honestly.
It absolutely is. And there could be so many number of reasons why they haven't released a lot of this to the public, and it could have something to do with the family. Maybe the family doesn't want it released, and it just depends on...
They're minors.
Yeah. And there's possible sexual...
Yeah, sexual assault, which you never want to go to, but...
Yeah, exactly. So it could have something to do with that, or... Who knows? Maybe the cops are just hindering their own investigation. I really hope that they solve it and then release everything.
I just feel like if you have more recordings, you should release it, especially if you have anything else of this guy's voice, more videos of this guy. If it's a longer video clip of him walking, people can look and see his gait. Is his gait different? Like,
the FBI could do a gait analysis, definitely. Well, okay, but then again, if those boards were, like, a little bit wider and uneven and everything, and that's the only video that they have, it could just skew the gait analysis also, so.
But at least let us see, like how he hunches over when he walks. Let us see more of his outfit. And it's frustrating. I want to know more.
Yeah, that's what definitely sucks about going into these cases, especially if someone hasn't done all the research or they can't find anything to give you answers, because you're just basically giving yourself all of these unanswered questions.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'm about to give you some more. We should just call this one Unanswered.
Unanswered and Unsolved.
Yeah, that should be the name of this episode. My case is the disappearance of Maura Murray. Have you heard of it?
I know this one.
Do you know anything about it?
A little. Not a lot, but a little.
When I was looking at lesser known stuff, and this one just kind of popped up, and I went, I'm going to look at that.
I think it's a good one, as good as in the sense it's interesting.
It is, yeah. There's a lot of unanswered questions with this one, too. I know that a lot of people have started to, in the recent years, started to, like, cover it, so hopefully this won't be, like, an overlap too much. The overall case of Maura Murray, so she was 21 at the time that she disappeared. And this was back in 2004.
Oh, so a little older.
Yeah, she's been gone. She's been gone a while. So Maura, she was born May 7th, 1982. And her parents are Fred and Laura Murray. And she has four other siblings. All of them are older except for her younger brother.
Damn, big family.
Yeah, there's two boys and two girls. And then there's Maura, obviously. So she was actually, she surprised me a little bit because she actually got a full scholarship to West Point.
Whoa.
Yeah, to study chemical engineering.
Holy, wow.
Yeah, right? Smart girl. And her elder sister, Kathleen, I'm so sorry. Kathleen, her older sister, also went to West Point. I don't know what she studied, but she was just following in her sister's footsteps, I think. But then she only stayed there for three semesters. And then she switched to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and she studied nursing.
Aw, still an admirable choice.
Yep.
She'd be needed right now.
Yeah. So she, that's where she is at this time. And then all of a sudden, February. Wow, my brain.
I know this case now that you say it. Yep.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
February 9th, 2004, she ended up crashing her car on this windy road. And then she disappeared.
Okay.
February 9th, 2004, the time of the crash is sometime after 7 p.m. The first police call is at 7:23 p.m. from some lady that lives nearby the crash. I think she heard it and she called the cops.
Uh-huh. So immediately after the crash, right?
Yeah, shortly thereafter. Yeah. Not long after at all. So we can just assume the time of the crash was around 7:20-ish, give or take a few minutes. And then the police actually arrived at 7:43 p.m., so about 20 minutes later.
Okay. Was it like a rural area where she crashed?
Yeah,
okay.
It's just a country back road, really. And the part where she crashed was in the, like, I think it was coming out of this really windy, like, S-curve.
Okay. It makes sense why it would take them 20 minutes.
Yeah. And then also, there was a second phone call to police. So there was this bus driver, and he was driving, he was on his way home, I guess, from his route. And he saw her car crashed, and he saw, I assume, Maura, somebody who matches her description, standing by the car. And he had stopped to ask her if she needed help or if she needed him to call the police. Mm-hmm. And he claims that she urgently said no, 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 that she had already called AAA.
Hmm.
That's the bus driver's statement.
Yeah.
So then the bus driver goes home, and he calls the cops anyway. And here's why. Because that area didn't have cell service. So the first lady that called from a landline, and the bus driver, when he got home 10 minutes later, called from a landline.
So she wouldn't have been able to call AAA.
Exactly. So her car, when she crashed, she had hit, like, the driver's side on this tree. She basically didn't take the turn with the road, and she just kind of drove off of it. And there were cracks on the windshield, and they started from the inside of the car. And it suggested that that's where the driver's head hit or something like that when she hit the tree.
Yeah.
But then there's also a little analysis done that the point where the cracks are is too high to match Maura. Like, if she had hit her head on the windshield, there, some of these sources are saying that she would have hit lower than what they were.
Oh.
So that's an interesting little tidbit that we have no other information about. So there's some unanswered questions for you right off the bat. Her car, when the police finally showed up at 7:43, her car was facing the opposite direction that she had been going.
What?
And the car was locked. Yeah. Right? And the car was locked. So maybe when she hit the tree, she, like, spun around or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. That's just speculation from me. But then the car was locked, and Maura was nowhere to be found. The cops didn't see her.
Hmm.
So they got into the vehicle, and there was an empty beer bottle in the back seat. So they thought that she had been drinking while driving, and maybe she left the car because she didn't want a ticket. And then there was a box of Franzia wine on the passenger seat, I believe it was, if I remember correctly. And it had been busted, probably due to the crash.
Mm-hmm.
They also found a rag stuffed into her tailpipe.
That's weird.
And they assumed it was from, yeah. They assumed it was from, like, the emergency kit in the car.
Why would you put it in the tailpipe?
Yeah, right? Why? I don't get it. What does that do? What purpose does that serve?
Yeah.
So there's some more questions. At some point during this investigation, the police went to search her dorm just to get more information on what was going on. And when they searched her dorm, most of her things were packed up and some of the art was taken off the walls. So it insinuated that she was moving.
Yeah, was this the middle of the semester, the end of the semester? Do you know?
In February? She was still taking classes, I know that for a fact. Because she had emailed
semester.
One of her, like, her supervisor in her nursing department, who I guess was also her boss, because she had emailed him to let him know that she would be gone for a little while.
Yeah, that's like the beginning of a semester.
Yeah. And then on top of one of the boxes, they also found an email. And at the beginning of my research into this, it just said that the email pointed to issues in her relationship with her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I found out that it was an email stating that he had cheated on her.
Aw, that's always sad.
Yeah, it is. All right, so that's everything that happened on, well, that's not everything that happened. That's, in a nutshell, this case. So we're going to go into the days leading up to her disappearance and her car crash.
Okay.
So on February 5th, so 4 days before this crash and disappearance, Maura had spoke to her sister Kathleen on the phone. And, oh my God, what are you doing? I guess she had a job as a campus security guard.
Uh-huh.
Because she had talked to her sister on the phone while she was at her job. And that was at It was before 10:30 p.m. So she had talked to her sister, I don't know how long. And according to her sister, in the beginning, she didn't want to give any information about the phone call other than she had been talking about issues with her and her fiancé. This is Kathleen. Uh-huh. Kathleen's the one that had issues with her fiancé. And then at 10:30 p.m., witnesses said that Maura just started crying on her shift.
Oh.
Yeah. Just sobbing, I guess. And then she was in, like, this weird trance where she was just zoned out. That was her supervisor that stated that.
Mm-hmm.
She was zoned out and unresponsive. And then at 1:20 a.m., the supervisor escorted her back to her dorm. So I guess her shift was over. So at some point during all of that, the supervisor asked her what's wrong, and the only thing she would say is, my sister.
And all they talked about was problems with the sister's fiance, supposedly? Mm-hmm. That's all the sister said?
Yeah. And then Kathleen later explained the entire conversation, and so Kathleen had gotten out of rehab for alcoholism that night that she called Maura. And apparently on the way home, her fiance decided it was a great idea to just take her to this liquor store on the way home. So she obviously felt betrayed and some other things and, like, broke down crying to call her sister.
Yeah.
First of all, don't marry that guy.
No, not at all. Pack your bags and run.
Okay, and then February 7th, 2004, so 2 days before her disappearance, her father, Fred, comes into town to visit her. And her parents had been divorced, I don't know for how long, and she had lived with her mother prior to being in the dorms. So I guess her dad would just come up to visit her, like any good father does. So Fred arrives in Amherst, and then on February 7th, they went car shopping. I guess he was going to get Maura a car. And then that night, they went to dinner with one of Maura's friends, which I don't remember her name. It's either Sarah or Katie, I think, but they don't really come into play very mm-hmm. often. So then after dinner, Maura drops her dad off at his hotel, and she takes his car. And his car is a black Toyota Corolla. No, I'm sorry. I don't know the color. It's a Toyota Corolla.
Yeah. Hold on 1 second. Ezra! Shut up! Good boy. Okay.
All right, so let's cut that part out because I hate it when I say that.
Black Corolla.
Yeah, a Corolla, a Toyota Corolla. So Maura takes her father's car and she goes back to the dorm because there's a dorm party that she wanted to go to. And then witnesses say she arrived at the party at around 10:30 p.m. or they might have gotten it from the CCTV from the campus.
Mm-hmm.
But she got to the dorm party at 10:30 p.m. And then by 2:30 a.m., she left the party. So here's how you get to know a little bit of her personality and how great of a driver she was.
Okay.
So Maura, at 3:30 a.m., so an hour after she left the party, she's driving back to her dad's hotel, and she strikes a guardrail. She crashed her dad's car.
Oh, my gosh.
His Corolla at 3:30 a.m., and it was a T intersection.
Uh-huh.
And the guardrail was at the, like, center of the T, the horizontal part. And she just crashes right into it.
Wow. I'm assuming she'd been drinking at the party.
Maybe.
So she probably Maybe. Is
Probably, actually. Yep, so... Oh, wait. She had. She had been.
Oh.
So she strikes this guardrail, and the cops show up, and there is a report completed. And then she did $8,000 worth of damage to her dad's car.
Holy.
It ended up being totaled.
I would slap the shit out of my kid.
So she gets a ride back to her dad's hotel, which is interesting. Like, why didn't you stay at the dorms?
Yeah.
Why are you going back to your dad's hotel? Why don't you just meet up with your dad the next morning to hang out?
That is a little bit weird, but it doesn't sound like she's thinking responsibly.
Yeah. Oh. Here's an interesting part. When the police arrived and completed the report, they did not do a sobriety test.
What?
So there's no way to know if she had been drinking or not. She probably had been, but we don't know.
That's the first thing I would have done.
This is 2004, though. Let's give them a little leeway.
At 3:30 in the morning and some little college girl crashes her car, in the center of an intersection, I would have said, okay,
little
lady.
She's this 21-year-old college student. She's got, like, this brown, blondish, like, dirty blonde hair.
She's like, been drinking.
They probably thought she was cute and let her go.
Oh, my God.
Just making sure she got a ride. Mm-hmm. Okay, and here's another weird part. At 4:49 a.m., there was a call placed from her father's phone to her boyfriend.
So it's probably her.
Probably.
I don't know why her dad would call Maura's boyfriend.
I don't know. But that's all the information that we had on it. They couldn't confirm who had called because Fred had claimed to be asleep and he didn't even know his daughter was in the room until he woke up a couple hours later.
Aw.
So who knows? Just a little odd tidbit.
Yeah.
Dad's phone called boyfriend's phone. All right, and then Sunday morning, so February 8th. Her dad rented a car, and then he drove to Connecticut.
Yeah, he had to rent a car because she fucking wrecked his car.
Hell yeah. And then I think that he drove around for work or he traveled for work, so, because I don't think he lived in Connecticut. But either way, he drove to Connecticut. So at 11:30 p.m. on February 8th, Fred called Maura and he wanted to, like, remind his daughter to go get this paperwork so they could file the insurance claim. And they made plans to talk the following night on February 9th.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to fill out the insurance form together on the phone. So the day she disappeared, she had plans to talk to her father. So then it was past midnight, February 8th going into the 9th, and she had map-quested directions to a couple of different locations in Vermont.
What's in Vermont?
Well, there was Burlington, Vermont, where she searched, and then the Berkshires, which I guess is a certain mountainous region, and it has, like, ski resorts and stuff.
Huh.
So maybe she was going on vacation.
Yeah, that was like the town she's going to stay in.
Yeah, she just crashed her dad's car. She's just going to go on vacation now.
$8,000 in damage, but doesn't a vacation sound nice right now?
Yeah. Dad, I know you're out $8,000 to $10,000, but I'm leaving. All right, so then we're going to get into all of the events on the day of the crash.
Okay.
And I'm going to get pretty detailed just to give you an idea of, like, all the random things that happened. It could be relevant to the case, and it could not. Who knows? Like, it's not my job. It's the cop's job. Are you excited about this case?
Yeah. Now? I like this case, so.
So, February 9th at 1 p.m., Maura emailed her boyfriend, and she told him that she didn't really want to talk to anyone, but that she promised that she would call him today or that day. And then she told him that she loved him.
So that's two plans that she's made for today.
Yeah.
Talk to her boyfriend, talk to her dad.
Shortly after that, she called another nursing student, and we don't know who she called or what she talked about. And then also at 1 p.m., she called a condo in Bartlett, New Hampshire, to ask about renting a place.
Wait, I thought she was going to Vermont.
Yeah, right? She can't decide.
Yeah.
So it was only a 3-minute phone call, and she didn't actually make a rental. So she's just inquiring at this point. She wants to get away, it seems like, and she doesn't know where she wants to go.
Yeah.
Probably the cheapest place.
Some stressful things have happened. She wants some alone time for a little bit. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. We can all relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, 1:13 p.m., that's when she called the nursing student. 1:24 p.m., she emailed her supervisor in the nursing department and told them that she had had a death in the family and that she would be gone a week, but that when she got back, she would let them know.
I mean, I've used that excuse before in school to get out of some shit, so.
Yeah, yeah. There was no death in the family.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
So yeah, it could just be an excuse she wanted to get away. Okay, 2:05 p.m., she called for more information on hotels in Stowe, Vermont.
Girl!
So she's just trying to figure out where she wants to go. She just knows she wants to go. And then 2:18 p.m., she called her boyfriend, but he didn't answer. So she left a voicemail and told him that they would talk later.
Okay. So sounded cool. Normal on the voicemail. Love you. Talk to you later.
Yeah. And then, okay, in her car, she had clothes, she had toiletries, college books, and birth control, which if you're getting out, like if you're trying to go on this little getaway and vacation because you want to be away from everything, why would you bring your college books?
Maybe she's going to do a little bit of homework then?
Maybe, but if I'm getting away from something.
So I think, though, that if you're planning on, because, you know, she's missing. I think that if you're planning on going missing, though, you wouldn't take your books.
Yeah, that's her. That's a good point.
Yeah, I think that was a, I'm going away for a week, might do a little bit of studying. Because I know nursing school is really intense. So maybe she's going to catch up on studying.
Yeah, that's a fair point. At 3:30 p.m., she drove off campus in a 1996 Saturn sedan, and it was black.
Was that hers?
I guess it's the one, I guess her dad got her a car when he visited, because they had gone car shopping, so that's, I mean, best guess. Sure. So her classes had actually been canceled that day because there was a snowstorm that was supposed to be coming in.
Oh.
So yeah, she didn't actually have any classes to attend to. So that kind of freed her up to just do all this packing and drive away. And then she was caught on CCTV at 3:40 p.m. where she withdrew $280 from an ATM. On this camera, she was alone. And then she went to a liquor store nearby and she bought $40 worth of alcohol. And it was like Bailey's Kahlua. That box of Franzia wine and something else.
Damn, that's a lot of alcohol. Yeah. For one person?
But, yeah. So, who is she going with?
That's a lot of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. A box of wine for yourself along with all of that?
I could see if she bought, like, one box of wine for this weekend or whatever. Yeah. But I can't see the wine. Beer, most likely, because beer was found in the car. Bailey's, yep. Kahlua. That's a lot.
It is a lot. And she was also alone on that CCTV camera.
Huh.
Her footage. She also at one point picked up her accident forms that day because they were found in her car. And between 4 and 5 p.m. she left Amherst. And the last call she made was at 4:37 to her dorm's voicemail. And she just checked to see if she had anything. And that was it. And I don't know if the police did, like, a search on her phone records or something later on down the line. Because I don't know if you could do that in 2004, but...
I would assume, I mean, so.
You might be able to just pinpoint her last location when she called the voicemail, but I don't know. So here's what was missing from her car. Her debit cards, or her debit card and her credit cards were both missing. Her phone was gone, and then some of the liquor that she purchased at the store was gone. Minus the box of Franzia wine because it had just exploded in her car. But the cards and the phone have not been used since she disappeared.
Well, that's a bad sign.
So either she's purposely missing or she's dead.
Yeah.
3 months later, there was an eyewitness report stating that this guy had witnessed a possible sighting of...
Was that your cat?
No, it's this. It's a bike down here. I'm going to repeat that anyway. I'll just cut that part out and let me repeat. Welcome to this part of Missouri where we have constant flybys of people with way too loud cars, your car alarm's going off, and dogs barking at any time of the day or night. Would you like to live here? No. All right, he's gone. 3 months later, an eyewitness stated that he saw a possible sighting of a female matching Mara's description. And it was between 8 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. on the night she disappeared, approximately 4 to 5 miles east of where her car had crashed. And her car crashed along Route 112.
Okay.
So he only came across this too because he was redoing some of his books for work or whatever. And that's why you only get the 8 to 9:30 p.m. time frame.
But it was only a possible sighting.
Yeah, had matched. The girl was wearing jeans, a dark coat, and a light-colored hood. And when Mara went missing, she was wearing jeans, a dark coat, and then a black backpack.
Okay.
So maybe. It could be. I don't know what happened with that. I don't know if the police followed up on that. I don't know what they can follow up with on that. So at 8 p.m., the crash site was cleared. At 8:49 p.m., the car was towed to a local garage. And then at 9:30 p.m., the last officer was on the scene. He left after that. So here's the other weird thing in this case. The tow company that towed the car wasn't the actual tow company that was on call for the night.
Okay.
But here's the other thing that really kind of pisses me off. Because he wasn't on duty, he towed the car to his private garage where it sat for 4 days.
Okay, yep. Can't. That's not allowed.
Yep. But also, the guy that was the tow company and the guy that was on duty for the night, he didn't understand why he didn't get a phone call, and he was pissed and started making some waves because he lost out on that fee for the night.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
That is really, that's just weird.
And I wasn't going to bring this up because me personally, I don't believe it just because of how wishy-washy it is and the information that I got. But there was another supposed witness that said she drove down the route past the car crash. And when she had done that, it was like 7:27, if I remember correctly. She said that she saw a police SUV parked nose to nose with Mara's car. And at one point, she said the police was marked 002. And then another point, she said it was marked 001. So there's already conflicting information. And she said there was an SUV, but when the cops pulled up, and she said there was an SUV before the cops got there, but when the official police report stated they got there at about 7:40 something.
Yeah.
So that's 20 minutes prior and only a few minutes after the first police call that she's claiming this SUV was nose to nose with Mara's car. So she is trying to insinuate that there's something going on with that police officer that drove that car, and that he has something to do with Mara's disappearance.
Oh, the officer that drove the SUV might have something to do with it.
Which is, how does he get there, you know, that soon, if that's the case?
Yeah.
I don't think he would, unless he just happened across it. She also stated that she was driving, and then she saw this same police cruiser put his lights on and go around her. And this was before the crash. And then she turned onto a different road and he put his lights on and went around her again. And then she saw a little bit later down the road that he was parked nose to nose with her car. That doesn't make any sense. How could he pass you twice?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
So I wasn't going to say anything about it because I discredit it. It's whatever. But her fan club has also decided to take it to social media. And the officer actually ended up killing himself because of it.
Oh my god. Cyberbullying is real, people. Watch what the fuck you say to others.
And like, maybe this guy had something to do with it. Maybe you're right. But at the same time, you're not going to get answers if he goes and kills himself because you cyberbullied him. They discredited his character, and then they left him so depressed that this guy didn't want to keep on living.
Yeah.
And this guy is just trying to do his job.
That's really sad.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I'm not going to say, like, the police did everything right in this case, because there's a bunch of times where, especially with the tow company, like, you tow the car to your private garage? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, how did the police not say, hold on, where's the driver? Bring the car to us.
Well, I don't think the police knew about it. And from the reports that I read, Fred Murray, Mara's father, is the one that found out that the car was in the private garage.
That's not how 4 days later. Happen.
Yeah. So I don't know. Fred was a big one on this case because he was like attempting to push people towards answers constantly.
Yeah.
So there's that. Cyberbullying is bad. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Be an adult. All right. Now we go into the days after the crash. So February 10th, there was a bolo put out for Mara. And the bolo stated she was wearing a dark coat, jeans, and a black backpack. This is the day after.
Uh-huh.
Her bolo wasn't put out the day of.
Well, you know, some police jurisdictions claim you have to wait 24 hours for a missing persons report, which is false, people. You can make it as soon as the person is thought to be missing. Don't have to wait 24 hours.
Yes, but even if that was the case, you have some suspicious circumstances, which means you should put a bolo out on this girl.
Yeah.
Her car has been crashed on a rural road, and a snowstorm is coming. Why wouldn't you put a bolo out on her? Yeah. At most, she could, I mean, like, at worst, she could probably freeze to death. If nothing else is going on, she might just be walking down the road because she doesn't want, like, a DUI or something. She could freeze.
It makes too much sense to put it out.
So that also makes me mad.
Yeah.
February 11th, 2004, an official search was started. 2 days later.
2 days later?
Yep. 2 days later.
Well, they kind of fumbled this one a little bit, huh?
Mm-hmm. I think there were unofficial searches around, but they only went a couple miles out. And maybe it was because of the snowstorm that was coming in. I don't know. But two days later, an official search was started. They used dogs to track the scent 100 yards east of the crash site, and then the dogs lost the scent. And the cops are stating that this is possibly because she got into another car.
Yeah.
But that's 100 yards from the crash site, so you're claiming she got into another car, and then 4 to 5 miles later, she got out of that car and started walking, if that possible sighting was her.
Yeah, if it was her.
Yeah. 5 p.m. on February 11th, the boyfriend and the parents arrive at the police station, and the boyfriend was questioned alone until 7 p.m., and then the parents were brought in.
Damn. That's a long questioning.
Mm-hmm. So during the flight, the boyfriend was stationed at Fort Sill. Is that Oklahoma?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So he was stationed at Fort Sill. So they got on a flight to go be there in person for the cops. During the flight, his phone was turned off, as it should be.
Yeah.
And he received a voicemail from a number that was issued by the American Red Cross. When he listened to the voicemail, he thought that it was Maura crying on the other end. Come to find out later, apparently the American Red Cross had been trying to get in touch with him because I guess he claimed that his fiance was missing. But nobody aside from him even knew that they were, quote, engaged.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Who knows? He was just trying to get emergency leave because he wanted to be there because she disappeared.
Okay.
Which we can all relate to.
Yeah, that makes more sense. Okay. At first, I was like, Red Cross? What the fuck? Where does this come in? But yeah, emergency leave makes sense.
Yeah. And then the Vermont authorities actually were not told of Mara's disappearance until at least a week after her disappearance. So, like, your neighboring states, you're not going to tell them? Because it was only a few miles. She could easily go into Vermont.
Cross over.
And she had made so many phone calls, that was probably where she was headed anyway. But yeah, a week after her disappearance is when they were told about it. And I think the father had something to do with that.
Oh my god. Communication between departments is so important.
Yep. 10 days after her disappearance, the FBI joined the search.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a second ground and air search with a helicopter with thermal imaging, cadaver dogs, and tracker dogs. During the search, the family was also searching, and Maura's sister found a ripped pair of women's underwear lying on the snow. But they later stated that the DNA came back and it did not have a match to Maura.
Okay.
So remind me when we're done with this case to circle back to that pair of underwear.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have some questions. Yeah, February 26, 2004, the DNA confirmed it was not Mara's. The police returned the items. Let me readjust, because this is pissing me off rereading this. The police returned the items from Mara's car to her family at the end of February. We don't know where she is.
Yeah.
They returned evidence.
But isn't that evidence for an ongoing case?
You should keep it, absolutely, because they don't know where she is. So even if she's just a missing person, shouldn't you keep the evidence from where she was last seen?
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe some fingerprint samples to see if it's not only Maura that's touched all the alcohol bottles.
Yep. March 3rd, 2004. The family checked out of their hotel that they were staying in because it was too hard on them. They went back home. because nothing was happening with the case. But then apparently Fred decided every single weekend he was coming back up to do searches of his own and to try to get the local community to help him out.
Yeah. And that's so hard because that's not the community that, like, you're not a standing member within that community. So people are going to look at you and be like, who the fuck's this dude, you know? Whereas, like, in my hometown, if, you know, someone from my family was like, hey, guys, someone's missing, everyone's going to be like, oh, my God, we know and we love these people. Let's immediately help them. But when some random guy.
Yeah, but apparently the locals here were actually super helpful.
Aww.
They helped tremendously.
Good.
And they helped with searches all the time. Unfortunately, in April, Fred had multiple complaints of trespassing. I mean, he's just trying to find his daughter, guys.
Yeah, I'd fucking trespass too if my kid went missing. If my dog went missing, I'd be trespassing.
Absolutely. 100%. I'm climbing on your balcony. My cat jumped on the roof a few months ago, and I couldn't get him. And he decided he was going to get himself stuck on someone else's balcony. I almost climbed on the roof to get onto their balcony to go get him. I knocked on their door, and they weren't home.
Aww.
Or they were avoiding me. But yeah. He was just stuck out there for hours. And I was like, crawl back to the roof, please. So he said at the end of February, the police gave all the items from the car back to the family. Okay. Which, if you're closing the case, it makes sense to give the family their items back. They didn't close the case, though.
And that's not long enough to close the case after that short amount of time. That ain't long enough.
July 1st, 2004, police got the items back from the car, from the family, so that they could do forensics analysis on it.
I hate them. Why wasn't that the first fucking thing you did in a missing persons case? Or at least, I don't know, seal the evidence like it's protocol within every single jurisdiction in the country.
Exactly. Because we all know there is a waiting list for forensics analysis,
yes.
Right? They just put the most relevant cases first.
I understand.
And she's a missing persons, and I guess the cops had this opinion that she had wandered off on her own, which it's not a bad opinion to have, but you're still cops. You still have to investigate.
Yeah, you still have an obligation to assume the worst here and investigate her presence. What the fuck? And there's this thing called chain of custody. You have to maintain chain of custody of this evidence, and you didn't when you gave it to the family. So all this evidence, if it ever went to trial, would be thrown out because who the fuck was touching all of this during the months the family had it? So they just fucked themselves if there's ever a trial.
Yep, absolutely. And one of the theories is that her father wasn't so loving. So if that even remotely came up to be true, the father has been touching all the stuff in the car. You're never going to be able to tell.
Oh my God.
Okay. A fourth official search was performed July 13th, 2004. And it was the first search without snow on the ground. And nothing was found.
Hmm.
Brace yourself. I'm so excited for this part. In late 2004, a guy gives Fred a rusty bloody knife, and he said that his brother had used it to kill Mara. A few days after he gave Fred the knife, his brother's Volvo was scrapped. And the guy also claimed that his brother and his brother's girlfriend were acting strange the day of the disappearance. Now, the family of these two guys claimed that the guy that gave Fred the knife was a drug user and that he was just trying to get reward money.
Oh.
All right, remember this. And then we're going to go to late 2005. There's a few things that happened here. So, first of all, there was this guy stepped forward in mid-2005, and he stated that someone who matched Mara's description, overall description, he had encountered her on a beach. But that she had stated that her name was Raquel, and her last name had started with a V, and it sounded French, but he couldn't remember.
Uh-huh.
Seems kind of insignificant, but whatever.
Yeah.
The beach was it was a beach on Lake Willoughby in Westmore, Vermont. So that was mid-June that happened. And then late June, a couple came forward and stated that they had seen someone who matched Mara's description, except she was blonde, at the Solid Rock Assembly Church of God in Barton, Vermont. and she had stated that her name was Raquel.
That's weird.
Yeah, it is weird. And then late 2005, November 1st, 2005, someone logged on with the username Tom Davies onto this chat room. And he stated that he saw a black backpack behind a restroom at Pemigewasset Overlook, which is 30 miles east of Woodsville, along Route 112.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it's along the same route at a restroom at an overlook, which, I mean, we'd all stop there if we got tired or had to use the bathroom or something.
And black backpacks are common. Sorry.
Yeah, that's true. It's just that it's along the same route. It's at an overlook where someone would probably stop if they were tired. And she had a black backpack when she disappeared. So it could have been hers. They could have taken it and done some DNA analysis or seen what was in the bag. Maybe her debit and credit cards were in there.
But I'm guessing they didn't.
I don't know. It's unknown as to whether the backpack was taken into evidence or even tested. But the detective at the time said that they are aware of the backpack.
So what do you do with aware. The backpack?
He used the word aware. So, like, did you get it?
They just knew that it was there. Great.
Moving on to October 2006. So at this point, the detectives in the case had just kind of written it off. She wasn't really, I mean, she was kind of a missing persons. It was suspicious as to why she was gone, but they just kind of assumed that.
Dude, she's definitely a missing person. She's definitely missing.
Yeah, so the case is still open, but they're kind of just stepping back and they're like, she kind of walked away. So local retired detectives and cops, private investigators, and some of the local community, along with the family, they did another search in October 2006, and the cadaver dogs had alerted onto this house that was 1 mile from the crash site. So they were sure there was a dead body in there somewhere.
At some point, yeah.
Yeah, they had thermal imaging. And there was, like, a disturbance near the basement of this house that was caught on thermal imaging. So they wanted to dig it up. They told the police about it. They wanted to have an investigation sent in. So they didn't have enough evidence for a search warrant. But the family that lived there gave the police, and I think the FBI did it all as well, they gave them permission to go into the basement, dig up part of the basement, see what was causing the disturbance, take some samples of the carpet, and send it off for analysis. So good on them. Like, this is a really, really nice couple that lives there.
Yeah.
The person that lived there in 2004 was none other than the brother of the man that gave Fred the knife.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. The thing that was underneath the basement was either a rusty pipe or something like that. So nothing came of that. But that's an odd coincidence,
that
don't
is.
You think? And it's only a mile from the crash site. Okay. Let me go back. The sample of the carpet was taken to the New Hampshire State Police. The results were not released to the public.
Oh, God. Well, clearly something was found, because if nothing was found, they would tell the public that.
Yep. So, we don't know anything about the backpack or if they even tested it. They gave the family the stuff back from the car and then tested it months later. And then we don't know the results of this analysis on the carpet. There's no telling.
Yeah, we have no idea what the police have. Well, I don't have a fucking case, apparently, because I just sat back, but...
And this is years after.
Yeah.
This is 2 years after. Then fast forward to 2007, someone anonymous had came forward, and it's on James Renner's blog, and he actually has a podcast and a blog, and he gets a lot of evidence, so definitely go there if you're looking more into this case, but also keep some of it with a grain of salt, because some of the links aren't up to date properly, and some of it, like, he really pushes his own opinion, but, I mean, of course we all do, because it's our own podcast and blog, so I get that. He digs so far into it. Again, there will be a link to his blog on this, but an anonymous source came forward and had emailed James Renner, and he had posted like the quote from it too, but long story short, this person had worked at a Citizens Bank, and when they got bored or something with their job, like we all do, they went around searching like famous names or whatever, yeah. Which is freaking cool. But he searched Maura Murray's name too. This person found an account attached to Maura Murray's name and date of birth, and it was an active account attached to a car loan. And in order to be an active account, it had to have had money deducted within 30 to 60 days, within the last 30 to 60 days to be considered active. And this was in 2007.
So someone's making payments on that car loan?
Yep. With an account attached to Maura's name.
Huh. And date of birth.
Yep, and her date of birth, which is interesting.
Yeah, identity theft, or maybe it's Maura.
But if you had run away like that and you were trying to start over, why would you use your name and date of birth?
Unless you're in a serious pinch, you probably wouldn't.
Yeah. Okay. That's basically my case, but I'm going to tell you a few other things about, like, the boyfriend and the father and a couple of other things that I found out after I had done my research. So let's go back way in advance.
Okay.
So Maura went to West Point, we already said. Smart girl. But at first I was like, why would you leave West Point and go to, you know, just a normal college?
Yeah, West Point's pretty hot shit.
Pretty prestigious. So it turns out that Maura had been caught stealing from the commissary. And instead of expelling her, they allowed her to withdraw. And then 3 months prior to her crash, she had admitted that she stole a credit card number and had used it to buy fast food. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't charged because she had to go through 3 months without anything happening. She had to have good behavior for 3 months, which was exactly leading up to she was still in her, like,
probation time.
Good behavior phase when she crashed her car, or she had just completed it, one of the two.
Wow.
Interesting. Yeah. Also, going back to the party that she went to, her friend had stated that, it turns out that there were three guys who did not go to the school that were at that party. And one of her friends stated that she left with one of the guys. So apparently she just left with this guy she doesn't know. And that's leading up into crash number one. Okay, boyfriend's name is Billy Roche. And again, he was stationed at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. But apparently in 2018, and there's more about this on the James Renner blog, there's more about this. He was put into investigation in 2018 for an alleged sexual assault. He also lost his job at Ray Group International because of so many complaints of, sexual harassment or something along those lines.
So not a good dude.
Not a good dude. At the time, remember her sister, Kathleen, how they had that conversation about the problems she was having with her fiancé?
Yeah.
Well, the fiancé at the time, who's now the ex.
Good.
The fiancé stated that Fred Murray was not a good guy, and that he was abusive. And he insinuated that he thought he had something to do. Well, he insinuated that Fred didn't care about his daughter's disappearance as much as he did when the cameras were rolling.
Oh. So he's like putting on it. But he went back every weekend.
That's the other thing. He did go back every weekend.
Oh, well, I want to believe he's a good dad.
I mean, there's nothing.
Other than that guy's statement, who wasn't a good dude, apparently, and is now an ex-fiance.
Yeah, he's the same guy that took Kathleen to a liquor store the day she got out of rehab for alcoholism. Yeah. So, not really a good dude. And she married him anyway, she might not have married him. He's the ex, so that doesn't necessarily mean they got married. But that is the case of Maura Murray.
So, what do you think happened?
You know, I really don't know, because there's a lot of evidence that points towards, yeah, maybe she just walked away. Or maybe she walked away from the crash and somebody picked her up and something bad happened to her and she was dumped far away. But there's that coincidence between the house that the cadaver dogs alerted to and the rusty knife. And the guy's name was Claude Morton, I believe. That was the guy who was accused. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what his brother's name is, who did the accusing. That's a weird coincidence. But then again, I want to know where this Volvo was scrapped.
Yeah.
That belonged apparently to Claude Morton. Because, yeah, maybe the cadaver dogs picked up on something, but maybe it had been in the Volvo or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's no telling. There's so many different pieces that could lead to a bunch of different theories.
Well, I think that she was likely going to get away, was going on vacation. A lot of stressful things were happening in her life. She may have been drinking, got into the mm-hmm. wreck, and she went to walk away from the wreck because she didn't want to get in trouble again, and someone picked her up and something horrible happened to her. Whether it was that guy, a transient driver, individual, I don't know. But I do think that she survived the crash, obviously, and then went to walk away and was taken.
Yeah, something happened.
Yeah.
Something definitely happened. We just don't know. So here's my, like, super, the question that just stands out. We have this guy that says that his brother killed this girl, and he may have, who knows. And then the cadaver dog's alerted to the house that the guy used to live in. That's super, super weird. And then not far from that home is where the underwear was found. Remember Kathleen found that pair of ripped underwear?
Yeah, so what else were you going to say about the underwear?
So was there no investigation into that? Like, we didn't, there's a pair of ripped underwear in this search on top of snow. It's not old, guys. And it's close to this guy's house, who, there have been claims that he killed her. There is a bloody knife.
Yeah, which may or may not have come from his house. Who knows?
Right, who knows? But, the brother gave it to Fred, though. So, we don't know. Something is going on with that family.
Yeah.
And that house, possibly that Volvo. Maybe there was a different girl that was assaulted or killed. And I think there's allegations that Claude Morton is a sex offender.
So even if they didn't kill Maura, that family needs to be investigated.
There's another case there. Yeah, absolutely. In March 2004, there was another girl who disappeared. And I believe she was 17 at the time. Her name is Brianna Maitland. She's still missing to this day. Nobody knows what happened to her. The FBI had already stated there was no link between Maura Murray's case and hers. But what if Brianna Maitland was the owner of the pair of those underwear?
Yeah. And it's not like they have tons of evidence in Maura's case. Like, all the evidence you gave back to the fucking family and then tried to get it back. Like,
yep. So that's my unsolved.
Thanks, I hate it. Unsolved rage.
I liked yours. I really liked yours. And hated it at the same time because I just want to know what happened.
I need more answers in both of these cases.
Yeah, right? There's so many different tiny leads that nobody ever just went through.
Yeah. But thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week with a brand new case.